Welcome, everyone. I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Rules. Today is, what's today, November 16th. The agenda today, we have two items on the agenda, informational meetings with invited testimony only. We're going to start off with Senate Bill 270A, and that was a bill we had last session, and we have some folks today to talk about what that bill was intended to do and where we are and how do we move forward. There was a lot of interest in continuing a discussion on that bill. And then we're going to hear from the Elections Division, the Office of Secretary of State, to talk briefly about potential changes at the national level that would affect us around the U.S. Postal Service and effect on vote by mail. So those are the items for today. Welcome, everyone. Good to see you all. We're going to start off with 270A. I'd like to open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 270A. And on the agenda, we had four individuals. Mr. Meek from the Oregon Progressive Party cannot join us today. Cheyenne has an update about that.
Mr. Meek, chairs and members of the committee, he informed us via email that he couldn't make it, and he attempted to send some testimony, and we're expecting it any time. If it comes in during the hearing, we'll put it on the shared drive and distribute copies. And if we get it after the hearing, we'll follow up via email with everyone to make sure that you've got it in hand.
Thank you, Cheyenne. So I'd like to call up Kevin Neely, Sal Peralta, and Steve Trout. And you should have all received in your email a copy of 270A and then also the SMS, the staff measure summary, I believe, Cheyenne sent around.
Seem to be a lot these days.
If you all recall from last time, not everyone served on the Rules Committee last time, but this was a bill to look at ways to provide some efficiencies and some tweaks to how campaign finance reporting is done. It had an illustrious moment on the House floor. And
why would you have to bring that up?
It was carried by
Mr.
Olson.
Co-chair. Notice I did not mention
how
that.
How about Bojo representative?
Wow. But, you know, some bills needed a second chance, and so we're back today. So, Kevin, if we could start off with you, please introduce yourself for the record. I think what would be helpful, particularly for those of us who weren't on the committee last time, is, you know, what was the bill about, what were we trying to solve, and where do we go next with it? And then I'd like Mr. Peralta and Mr. Trout to jump in on that. So.
Thank you so much, co-chair, and committee members. My name is Kevin Neely, and I am the president of C&E Systems, and my company handles political campaign finance reporting for a lot of candidates and political action committees. Senate Bill 270, we'll just call it the bill from here on out, it has indeed had a unique history. But that being said, I think the principles behind it are sound principles, and there are important things that need to be addressed by the legislature. And I would very much like the opportunity to move forward with this bill as soon as possible for a number of reasons. The bill does three main things, two of which are relatively modest changes, and the third of which was, I thought, a modest change, but turned out to not be such a modest change. Number one, the bill eliminates pledges from the definition of a contribution in election law. This is a good piece of policy for a couple of reasons. The main reason is it's, in my view, the one piece of the election law that is still a very gray area. What might be a pledge to one person running for office may not be a pledge to the next person running in office, and certainly no two people view the pledge in the same way. And I think the pledge is also a piece of law from the old system where we only had reports come in on a quarterly basis. And so it was important to know if there was a giant contribution that was coming down the pike in the last few weeks or a few months of the election. But today, as you all know, the system requires a constant stream of reporting, and down into the last 6 weeks of the election, it's seven-day reporting, which has really minimized the need to have the pledge in there. Second important reason to remove the pledge from the system is it really is, I believe, a prohibitive piece of the law when it comes to deciding whether or not you want to seek office. Right now, a pledge is equal to a contribution. And so if you get pledges for over $700, even just, again, we don't know what the definition of a pledge is. There's a definition in the manual, but even that's hard to put real borders around. But if you get a couple people that say, hey, if you wanted to run for office, I'd give you $500. That might be two pledges for $1,000, and if you were considering running for office, you'd be obligated to open a political action committee. And obviously, once you've opened that committee, brings the media, brings all sorts of reporting responsibilities. So a second important reason to just get rid of this pledge system is it allows a little bit more flexibility on the front end for people who are actually legitimately testing the waters, don't know what they want to do. They're going to go out, they're going to talk to a few people and say, hey, I'm considering this. Would you be interested in supporting my campaign? They can do that now without having some reporting requirements with the Secretary of State's office. So that's the pledge piece. The second piece of the bill, it eliminates the requirement the Secretary of State's Elections Division needs to collect bank account information for all of these political action committees. I think that's probably all I need to say on that. The collection of bank account information isn't necessary for the Secretary of State's office to do their day-to-day work. If they need to audit one of these political action committees, they can do so, and at that point, get that information directly from the committee. Right now, it's just something they have to store. It poses a number of challenges. One, obviously, it requires them to keep track of some information that, if leaked, could be very, very damaging. We've heard story after story in the media over the last few years about the leaking of Social Security numbers or banking information. That'd be problematic. Two, it provides a real chicken and egg problem for organizations trying to create a committee. When you go to the bank, they say, well, we'd like to see your committee documentation. And when you go to the Secretary of State's office, they'd say, well, we'd like to see your bank account information. And so it's very complicated to go and get either the bank account set up or to get the PAC set up without having the bank account information or without having the PAC information. And so if the Secretary of State's office doesn't require that information up front, you can say, I'm going to go open an account at, you know, bank number X, get the committee set up, get the bank account set up, and not run into problems on either end. So again, provides a double benefit if we do away with that. Fortunately, both of those topics didn't seem too controversial the last session. The third topic is the one that, frankly, is nearest and dearest to my heart and does elicit the most controversy, and that is putting a cap on penalties for late filings of campaign finance information. Going back a few years in 2006, as you all know, the rule regime and the reporting regime changed dramatically. In 2009, the legislature put a lowered cap, a lowered percentage on penalties that were incurred by committees. They lowered it from 100% of the amount to 10%. But in doing that, they completely eliminated any cap. And so for the first time in a very long time, certainly as long as I've been around, there was no cap on the amount of penalty, civil penalty, that could be imposed for certain types of transactions. There are only a handful of transactions that ever exceed the amount that I proposed in this bill. In the bill, it was a $5,000 a month cap. That got a lot of people concerned, as all of you heard on that illustrious day in the House that hopefully will be beyond my memory soon. And so at this point, I've worked with the folks that were opposing the bill, at least folks that I knew were opposing the bill. There may be others out there. And I have I've come to them with a different solution. This time, I'm going to seek a flat $10,000 per transaction cap. The reason that I selected that this time is because back in the pre-ORSTAR days, it was a $10,000 per report cap. So this is a significantly higher cap. And frankly, it's probably only going to affect, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen transactions every year that exceed the $100,000 mark. It is a small number of transactions, but why it's important is for businesses like mine, I can't get insurance. I cannot get insurance to cover errors and omissions because no insurer is willing to take on the risk for a business that has unlimited liability. And even with a $10,000 per transaction cap, I promise you I'll have a lot of liability based on all of my committees. And so this is just a practical, I think, an important cap that protects businesses like mine from having a penalty that would often arise from not some sort of malicious intent, but a filing error. And the type of filing error that we can envision seeing penalties like this emerge from is if we had to go in and change the name on a committee. We got money from a corporation or from a union, and we thought the union or the corporation gave the $10,000 or $100,000 check, and instead it was their political action committee. We didn't know that at the time. We found out 35, 40 days later. We have to go back. We have to change the name. We're not changing the amount. We're not changing the address. All we're doing is changing the name. We're subject to that penalty because you can't change a name without getting a penalty after the 30-day mark. So that's an example of the kind of transaction that I'm concerned about. Again, I had hoped in the initial iteration of this bill that I could provide some, we could get some broader protections in place that would affect every committee, because I think right now there's a huge risk for every committee out there to incur a significant amount of civil damages just by making honest mistakes. But it looked like there wasn't the stomach for that. And so this time around, I think we've landed on a number that at least the folks that I've been working with can all agree on. And my hope is that moving forward, that obviously the people who matter most, you all can agree on a number like that. So that's a background piece on Senate Bill 270. And a kind of hope that I have moving forward to see this legislation through. I do think it's important legislation. I thank you for your time, and again, I thank you for enduring that rather bitter day on the House floor. I know it wasn't fun for anybody, and I promise you it wasn't very fun for me either.
Thank you, Kevin. And colleagues, if we could, I'd like to hear comments from the rest of the panel before we do questions, if that would be all right. Sour Steve? I mean, and frankly, this is open. This is an open conversation where you can respond to what Kevin has said or however you want to add to where we are with this bill and how you feel about it. And whoever wants to go first.
I would just say that I think... I'm sorry. Madam Chair, distinguished co-chairs, honorable members of the committee, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon, which was one of the organizations that oppose Senate Bill 270A in the last legislative session. I think Kevin's characterization of the legislation is basically accurate. The two provisions relating to deleting the definition of pledge from the reporting requirement and then eliminating the requirement that the Secretary of State take bank accounts from committees, we have no objections or concerns there. I think most of the objections on the floor stemmed from, exactly as Kevin said, just some concerns that very large committees through, by paying a comparatively small fine relative to the amounts of monies that are moving through those committees, could entirely circumvent the state system of contribution and reporting. One thing that didn't get much discussion of when this was heard in committee previously is the matrix that the state uses for assigning these penalties. Kevin correctly states that there's a maximum 10% fine that can be imposed on any transaction. So if you make a $2,000 transaction, you're liable for a maximum $200 fine. But the way that in the administrative rules the Secretary of State has been implementing that is that it's not a flat 10% penalty. You don't get a $200 fine automatically. It's only if you don't report it for a certain period of time. So on the first day that you don't report it, you're up on the hook for 0.5%. On the second day, it's 1%, and so on up till you reach 10%. So the only way to get a 10% fine is to fail to report for an entire month, basically. Otherwise, you get some lower percentage in 0.5% increments per day up to 20 business days. So I think that's just important information for the committee to have, because we're not just, if you make a mistake on a $5,000 filing, you're not automatically on the hook for a $500 fine. It might be only $50 or $100, depending on how quickly you catch the mistake and correct it. Now, having said all of that, I certainly don't have any objections to the cap that Kevin has pointed out, I think moving it from a per-month basis to a per-transaction basis actually makes a lot of sense. I would just say that before the body considers a bill that's only going to affect a very small number of transactions, and by definition, the wealthiest, most powerful PACs in the state, because there's very few people that are going to be making $100,000 contributions to a candidate. There's very, very few candidates that are going to receive a $100,000 check from somebody. And before you tailor a piece of legislation specifically to benefit the most powerful among us and to facilitate potentially them circumventing some of their reporting obligations, I think you should also look at maybe adding another piece of legislation that would just strengthen our state's disclosure requirements. You considered what we've referred to as the Truth in Campaign Advertising Bill, which was House Bill 2893 from the last legislative session. I think the colleagues of yours that were the strongest in opposition to the House Bill 270A were the champions of that bill. So I would encourage you, you know, as part of thinking about this issue of campaign finance reporting, that you think about both sides of this. One, making it easier for folks like Kevin to get errors and omissions insurance, but also two, that you take a good look at enhancing campaign disclosure, particularly as it relates to direct mail and communications with the general public. So those are my suggestions, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Oh, just a quick follow-up. The bill number was 2893?
Correct.
The one you referenced? Thank you, Sal. Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Elections Director. We're back primarily as can we make this work? How can we make this work within Orastar? And so clearly there's no problem from our perspective either with eliminating the pledges or the bank account requirements, you know, especially with the bank account requirement. That's you know, potential liability for us if that gets released, and something that would be good for us not to have to worry about tracking and protecting. With respect to the cap on penalties for certain transactions, within Orastar we can make that work. Actually, with the move to a per transaction limit, that's actually a lot easier for us to implement and administer, rather than the accumulating up to $5,000 over a month and then having to figure out which time period those fall into. So this proposed amendment that Mr. Neely's presented actually makes it easier for us to implement and program within Orastar.
And a follow-up on that, when we had this bill last time, were you anticipating any kind of fiscal impact for the per-transaction cap?
Madam Chair, there was a fiscal. I'm sorry, I didn't bring that with me. I know there was. There will have to be some programming changes within Orastar to be able to track those those limits. With a per transaction charge, it should be minimal.
Well, thank you. Before I do my questions, I'd like to make sure the rest of the committee. Steve, will you finish? Because I would.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Chair Kotek. As my usual line of questioning goes, I'm trying to figure out what problem we're trying to fix. So has there been a lot of fines? I mean, is there a lot of fining going on for this top level of folks? I mean, how much were all the fines in the last election cycle in 10? Was it a ton of money, a few? I mean, what are we trying to do here?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, the higher the threshold, the fewer the penalties that there are. So, you know, I believe really this is a cap for Mr. Neely to be able to administer his business. But as far as the number of transactions over the $100,000 threshold here that this cap would apply to, the number is small for any election.
So how many fines were given at that level? This last election cycle in 2010, at the over $100,000 level.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, for this last year, I'm not sure I had the numbers run from 2007 through through yesterday, and the number I think was in the 300 range. 300 transactions over that 5-year period.
Of all values or of over the 100,000?
Over 100,000.
And how many fines were imposed to that 300? There was 300 fines given to that group, or there was 300 transactions?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, there were 300 transactions. The number of fines, I don't believe there were any.
Okay. So the problem, the potential problem exists then?
Mm. Correct.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Steve, talk a minute about the bank account issue. Do you recall, you weren't around, but does anybody recall why we asked for that in the first place? What was the policy goal of having that information stored at the same? I mean, I remember an era when that was standard information, and now it's dangerous information for anybody to hold. So what's the implications of taking it out of there? What were we trying to do? What were we trying to get when we asked for it?
Madam Chair, I think Representative Barnhart has the has the answer. I was not here, but you know, I think as was mentioned earlier, it would have had to do with being able to track the account. But maybe Representative Barnhart can.
Thank you. If I may, Madam Chair, this was adopted either during the time I've been in the legislature or since I ran for the school board the first time. I can't remember which in Eugene. That was 1994. And I've always had a bank account for a separate bank account for my campaign, because as a lawyer I'm used to the idea of having a trust account for money that's not mine.
Commingle.
You know, that's perfectly normal to do. It wasn't required before that. People commingled their personal funds and their campaign funds in one checking account before. I think it's very reasonable that we have a rule that you have a separate checking account. But I think that the point of it was to allow the Secretary of State a way of enforcing it, to make it not only a pious wish, but an actual way for them to figure out whether you had a separate bank account for your campaign or not. I think that was the point of it. And of course also, that if they needed to, they could audit it.
Well, then if we take it away, do we run the risk, and this is my real point, of allowing some commingling, and how can you be sure that there isn't commingling? Because he's exactly right. That's what we're trying to get at.
Sure. So, Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think clearly the requirement to maintain a separate bank account exists. All this bill does is removes the requirement to report the account number. It still has the institution and the name of the account, but just omits the bank account number.
One more follow-up. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I want to be real sure that if there is any question about commingling, do you have the authority to go look and see that it's happening or not? In this language, are we taking away your ability to be sure that there is compliance? Because I think this is an important thing, that we're real clear. You cannot commingle these funds, and the Secretary of State has the authority to make sure you don't.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I'm going to need to read the bill closer to make sure that we're not losing that opportunity, because we do need the ability to be able to go in and work with these financial institutions to audit and to make sure all of the rules are being followed and that we have access to the information we need to validate that. I think the concern in the bill is the potential public nature of that
account. I understand
account,
that. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Absolutely, and I'm confident that those here at the table with me have no problem and want to make sure that we still have access to that information and we can make that work.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that topic before I move on to Representative Olson, if you had to audit a PAC and they're supposed to have a checking account for that PAC, and in what they have in their account doesn't match what they've been reporting in ORSAR, because you have a total amount. My checking book balance matches my PAC line by line. You would know that they're commingling right off the bat. I mean, there wouldn't be a way for them to somehow have a separate account somewhere. I mean, it would be pretty clear if there was a problem with that one account right off the bat, right?
Madam Chair, I think we'd be able to track that very clearly.
All right. Thanks. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for all three of you. At the end of the session, there was a bill that was floating out there. Actually, not a bill, but an amendment to this bill. And what it basically did was create, it identified the two election periods of the year, of the cycle, and increased the penalty during that time period, and then returned it back to basically what 270 was based on. We never really did flush that out here in the committee. I'm curious what your thoughts were on that.
Co-Chair Olson, I support a cap, and I think that, again, I regret that I'm here saying to you that the cap I've proposed is a cap that will affect probably at the most 10 committees in the state. And I'd point out that of those 10 committees, I'm not the treasurer, I suspect, on any of them. You folks are the treasurers on those committees. So it's not here. I'm just trying to protect my business. But that being said, initially the bill was crafted in a way that I thought would save committees the risk and, frankly, the need to hire a firm like mine. Representative Freeman earlier asked about the number of penalties that were over $10,000. And the answer is there have been quite a few penalties that have been over $10,000. Most of those folks write the check and then come knock on my door. They're not penalties that my firm has incurred, with one exception, and it was painful. They are penalties that volunteer treasurers have incurred. And so one of the accounts we got last year, the poor guy had $27,000 in penalties. He tried to report everything timely. He tried to report everything properly. And he didn't get the file button pushed. The numbers all went in there. He just didn't take the last step of pushing the file button. And he didn't do it for 9.5 months. And as a result, his PAC had to pay a $27,000 penalty. He paid it personally in this instance. Fortunately, I suspect it was a stretch for him to pay it, but he didn't feel like he could impose that on his members that were paying into that PAC. And in the old format, this bill would have helped those folks substantially, but in this format, I don't think it would. The biggest transaction in that instance was probably a transaction of, you know, $1,500, maybe $2,000. And so, again, I think that I think it's a good idea. One, we ought to get a cap in there for folks like me that really need to have the ability to at least insure our company. And two, we ought to have a discussion about ways that effectively help folks who make honest mistakes. Because this is a system in which I think 99.9% of the transactions that are filed, people try to do them honestly. They're running for public office, and they want to do the right thing. But it's not, I mean, this is hard work. It's hard to do this. And a lot of you do your own books. This is one of the rare committees where a lot of you do keep your own books. It's complicated stuff. And so I think, again, it's worth having the discussion, Chair Olson, about a period of time that's not as close to the election, where the learning curve for a new treasurer doesn't have to include the potential for draconian penalties. But it does make sense that in the last few weeks before the election, we need to do all we can to abate the possibility that someone will willingly not adhere to the law to try to gain an edge in the course of a political campaign. That's clearly not appropriate. But it's also not necessarily a great thing to have someone paying $27,000 or $15,000 or $11,000. $11,000 out of Bend for the Bend Central Republican Committee. And the dude had maybe $15,000 total in the pack, and he got a penalty like that. And so, you know, but it's hard to commingle a solution to that with the need to insulate the system from people who may want to abuse it, though I can find no evidence of that ever occurring. Someone incurring a $10,000 penalty back when there was one just to not report and gain an edge in an election. I don't think it happened pre-2006. And I went back as far as the records I could find. But sorry, that's a long answer. The short answer is it's probably a good idea, but I don't want to run into the same trouble we ran into last time, because that was not so fun for anybody.
The only response I'd make is that under the current system, it's a maximum of 10% of the transactions, and that metric accrues by a half a percentage point a day for a month. So if you have $27,000 in campaign finance violations, it's because you had $270,000 in transactions that you either didn't report or you incorrectly reported, and that stayed out there for a long period of time. I am very sympathetic to the idea that legislation could be considered that would somehow hold people who are clearly behaving with bad intent to a harsher standard than people who are not. But what that would look like, I don't have any thoughts for the committee. I would, to some extent, dispute some of Kevin's characterizations about what Kevin considers a volunteer treasurer is not necessarily what everybody considers a volunteer treasurer. Kevin will consider a paid staff person who is, staff person who's paid to do that, but has maybe not seen any systems. When he's referred to volunteer treasurers, oftentimes he's talking about a paid staff. So with regard to the suggestion, Chair Olson, that you had made, again, I tend to think that to the extent that any changes need to be made, I think they should be limited to a per transaction basis, and that the transactions need to be sufficiently punitive so that if a larger committee chooses to defect through ill intent, that they're discouraged from doing so. And I should bear in mind that the idea of a committee taking a $100,000 contribution or a $200,000 contribution or $1 million contribution, it is something that is just not possible in most states. Can't do it in a federal election, can't do it in most states. The fact that Oregon has no limits of any kind on campaign contributions lends itself to abuse, potentially, in terms of reporting, because all we have is reporting in this state. And so we need to make sure that folks are reporting correctly and appropriately.
Andy, any follow-up?
Other than curious what Steve's got to say.
Steve?
Madam Chair, thanks. Real quick, you asked the fiscal we had for the last version of the bill earlier this year was around $25,000. With going to a per transaction matrix, that would not require as much development, because there's not as many variables there. And that goes to Representative Olson's question, that the more differences we have as far as what the rules are at different time periods is going to require a more complex development of the ORSTAR system to be able to know, to be able to turn it on when we're going to have a certain rule and then turn off a different rule, and we're going to have higher penalties here and this learning curve here. We can do all that. It will just be more complicated, take more time and more resources.
Okay. Thank you.
So, yes,
Representative Colby.
Thank you. Sal, I just wanted to go back to the point that you were making about potential abuse. We have had this system for some time, and we've had this system of unlimited contributions for some time as well. And, I mean, I'm not the person in this building who's going to claim that Oregon politics is completely corruption-free, but compared to other states, many of whom do have campaign contribution limits, is there any reason to believe that Oregon's system is more corrupt or has more instances of corruption? I mean, there seemed to be an inference in your statement that somehow because we don't limit contributions that lends itself to some abuse, but, I mean, we've been running this experiment for a long time and I don't see it.
Well, actually, Chair Kotak, Representative Wingard, Oregon has had contribution limits for most of the state's history. It's actually a fairly recent development that we don't. The contributions that we had at one point into the early 1970s included an absolute cap on the amount that campaigns could spend. The legislature is part of an effort to move a public financing bill. So I've heard back in 1971 repealed those limits. Voters went to the ballots, passed limits in 1994. Those limits were struck down in the state Supreme Court after being in place for one election cycle. And in 2006, voters overwhelmingly passed contribution limits. So I'd say that only about 34 years out of the full life cycle of the state have we not had contribution limits. I'd also point out that the idea that we haven't had problems could be somewhat a function of the fact that for the entire period that we're talking about, we've had very high penalties for noncompliance. Through 2006, it was a minimum, it was a $10,000 fine up to the amount of the contribution. That's a significant penalty. From the period following 2006 through today, it's 10% of the total contribution. That is a very significant penalty. When you're talking about lowering that to $5,000 for an entire campaign over an entire month at perhaps the busiest time of the campaign, you could be talking about $1-3 million in transactions that don't, maybe more, that don't get reported. I mean, that's that $5,000 number for many of the campaigns that are in that situation is less than the cost of complying with the reporting.
Well, I wasn't arguing with that point, and nor am I advocating for the bill. I just thought I heard you suggesting that somehow because we don't limit contributions, a policy we have had for nearly 3.5 decades, that has encouraged or led to some unusual level of corruption in government. And so, I mean, I'm a person who happens to be okay with the idea that we don't have campaign limits because I don't see the pressing need. I mean, we have an experiment we've been running, and a lot of other states have been doing something else, including the feds. And I don't think the argument can be made that Oregon is just this bastion of corruption while these other states have cured it with their campaign finance limits.
Chair Kotek, Representative Wingard, I view Oregon as the land of clean air, clean water, and clean politics, and I think that reflects well on you. I'm not claiming that there's an inordinate amount of corruption. I apologize if there was that inference.
Thank you.
Makes you want to cry, doesn't it?
Representative Holt.
Thank you. I was wondering if someone could refresh my memory on what the matrix for penalties is currently. And since this proposed $10,000 limit, I suppose, is the transaction considered when you're fined 2 years later for the transaction, or is it at the first, the front end of the transaction?
Go ahead.
Co-chairs, Representative Holvey, the matrix is from the clock starts ticking the day it's late. So after 30 days or after 7 days, it's 0.5% per day, as Mr. Esquivel, Mr. Peralta, two sals, Mr. Peralta had said earlier. And so after 20 days, you're at full 10%. And then it's a flat 10% on any balance adjustments that are made. So if you do get out of line with your bank account, and that certainly does happen, it's a straight 10% that's taken off the amount that you have to adjust to get your PAC account back, your OrStar account back in line with your bank account. So those are the ways the penalty matrix works. I think it's important to look at this historically as well. Prior to the implementation of OrStar, it was a 10% or sorry, a $10,000 per report cap. It was not a per transaction cap back then. And so you could go at times half a year and be subject to a full $10,000, a maximum of $10,000 for 6 months. And then as it got closer to the election, that period of time was condensed to a period of the shortest period was 4 days. There was a 4-day pre-election report, and that's really going into the Wayback. Well, that's kind of going into the Wayback Machine. I suppose it's all relative here, isn't it? But certainly in terms of OrStar, that's just before OrStar. So that's the way that the penalty matrix was then. And then at the when OrStar was first implemented, it was still a 100% cap So you could get 10, it was 1% per day up to 100%. And then in 2009, that shifted to 0.5% per day up to 10% of the total. So that's the history of the penalty matrix. And I have one.
Yes, follow-up.
And so this bill doesn't mess with that matrix. It doesn't change that matrix at all.
This bill doesn't change that matrix in any way. It's again, a fair matrix, I believe, that it certainly does provide a incentive to get to rectify your mistakes as quickly as you possibly can. And the challenges that are here are that, remember, 30 days, if you write a check on the 1st, you haven't even gotten your bank statement within 30 days. Now, fortunately, the world has changed, and we can now access our bank account information online and all of that. But that's the real challenge here. Not even, I mean, the IRS expects you to be accurate within about a year. And Oregon expects you to be accurate within 30 days. And I challenge any of you to keep your personal banks accurate, your personal bank book accurate within 30 days. It's pretty darn hard to do. And so little mistakes happen. And the real risk is when big mistakes happen. And often it is just a completely honest mistake. And I do think that there haven't been any episodes in which we've had a candidate. Well, that's not true. Think of one instance where a candidate used their money for personal purposes. But in terms of purposely not reporting, frankly, the bigger risk is in your treasurer embezzling from you. And there's a case out of California within the last 2 months or 3 months that has really turned the federal system upside down because the woman embezzled so much money from her clients. And so I think more than anything, the candidate, instead of trying to make sure they get everything reported accurately, the better thing to do is make sure you read that darn bank statement every month to make sure your money hasn't walked away from you. Because that, and I think that's been a bigger problem in Oregon, too. There has been a significant amount of embezzlement out of political committees. And that's a bigger issue than is any instances of false reporting for the purpose of political gain. So,
well, on the issue of the treasurer, well, first of all, because some people might be watching this in the late night in their home, ORSTAR is the online reporting system that everyone can access on the Secretary of State's website, where you can actually see and search by political action campaigns or candidates to find out who's given what when. So that's what ORSTAR is for those who are listening. On the treasurer issue, I just want to clarify, because Sal brought up the point about volunteer versus paid. I just want to clarify what my understanding is, and I'm directing this to Steve to make sure I get this right. If you are listed on the PAC as the treasurer, you are personally liable for mistakes. For example, I'm the treasurer in my PAC. I use CNE systems to help me with my reporting, but I am the listed treasurer. So if they screw up or I screw up, I'm the one held liable. Is that true?
Madam Chair, yes. You're the one that we will contact as the treasurer of record.
Okay. So when that could be a volunteer, could be a paid staff person, but there is an individual liability there.
Yes.
And in the case of Kevin, I mean, I guess one of the questions I would have is, you're not the only person who runs a business in the state doing this, right?
No.
I mean, there's not a ton of them, but there are folks who do this, and there are reasons for that.
Right. Right. Madam Co-Chair, member of the committee, there are a handful of us that do this, and I encourage people daily to get into this line of work because there's too much work for me to do. My firm is at capacity. The reason we're at capacity is because it's really hard work and it's a huge risk. And I promise you that the reason that people come to me isn't because they can't do the books. It's because they're afraid to do the books. Every day I hear that. I don't want the risk. Kevin, will you be my treasurer? And my answer is, I'll be your treasurer. And my wife's answer is, Kevin, I don't want you ever to be the treasurer on a committee again. And your spouses all should be saying the same thing when there's no protections whatsoever. It's fraught with risk.
This reminds me, I need to change you to my treasurer, by the way. And I do appreciate Sal's analysis of, you know, these are really big contributors who might have this $10,000 fine. But I think I go back to the business interest. You know, you cannot get any insurance because there is no cap. We had a cap once. It worked. We're essentially, we go back to that with the proposal you're making. You know, the $5,000 over the course of the, whatever the number was in the last bill, wasn't the right way to go. I think we heard that. But to address the issue of the small businesses who do this, having something for liability reasons makes a lot of sense. I think one of the things I would say is Co-Chair Olson and I have been discussing this bill as a potential committee bill, and we wanted to hear from proponents and opponents today and neutrals of how they felt about it. So I just wanted to make that clear to the committee that, you know, depending on this conversation today, we'd like to come back and consider a committee bill if people feel it's valuable. I think we've heard reasons why it's valuable to proceed within the limitations that have been proposed, not try to take on the other issue of, or we could, but it is a lot more complicated that, you know, the change in the North Star that would protect different parts of the campaign cycle. Other questions or comments for the panel? Final remarks? Anybody didn't get to say their piece?
Thank you.
I think we're good. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. And we'll be back on this topic likely at the December meeting, potentially. So, great. Thank you.
We have a December meeting?
January.
January. That's right. We're not meeting.
We'll be here in December. Getting ready for our January meeting.
We'll be having it right too. In mid-January, we'll be back. So, since Mr. Trout is still there, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 270A and...
You could have left it open.
We could have left it. We're still in information. So let's talk about the Postal Service and vote by mail. And
thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe for the December or January, whatever meeting, you can all change chairs again, because every time I come in here, it's a different layout.
So we're keeping it interesting.
You're confused.
I put on my glasses by my name.
Oh, yes. So
you're closer now.
So thanks for a few minutes just to talk about some of the changes and issues that are coming up with the Postal Service. Obviously, with our election system being all vote by mail, there are major concerns and issues that we need to watch and prepare for. The Secretary and I met with the higher-ups in at the Portland Regional Facility here a month or so ago, just to kind of gauge a lot of the different things that we're hearing, both from Congress, from the Postal Regulatory Commission, from the regional post offices, reading in the press. There are a bunch of different variables that are all in play and no real certainty at this point, but thought I'd at least make you aware of what we know and what we're doing to prepare for that, and that we may need to be here in February talking about some statutory changes. So the first and easiest issue is there will be a 1 cent increase in the rate of postage. How that affects my life is that change happens right in the middle of ballots being out in the field for the special election in the 1st Congressional District. So we will mail them out under the current rate, and then while the ballots are out, they will the postal rate will go up, and that postage will be required to return your ballot. Good news is most people now use forever stamps, so that won't change anything for them, but we will be advertising in the voter's pamphlet this fact just so that the public is aware that this change will be happening. So that's the first issue. Second issue is the discussion of eliminating Saturday delivery. Obviously, that's takes a few days away from us, both for outbound ballots and inbound ballots. Currently, the window we have to mail ballots out is you can start on Friday, 18 days before the election, through Monday, the 14th day through the election. Most people have their ballots there at midnight at 12:01 on Friday morning to get those into the stream, so that many, especially those in more urban areas, will get their ballots on Saturday. Without Saturday delivery, they won't have that. The latest information, and this is all part that Congress will have a say in as far as whether that will be approved or not, but the latest information we have is that won't take place until 2013 at the earliest, so it won't impact this 2012 presidential election cycle. Also out in play is the study currently going on for the closure of local post offices throughout the state, throughout the country. We've looked at that, and really as far as election administration goes, that's not of much of a concern for us. The deliveries will still take place to the residents' addresses. Really the only thing that would limit us is somebody needing to go in and buy a stamp or drop a ballot off from one of those retail facilities, but we're not too concerned that that's going to impede or slow down ballot delivery or return. What will have a significant impact, and the thing that I am most concerned about, is the they're also investigating and looking at closing the regional processing facilities. So currently we have them in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Bend, Pendleton, and Medford, and then some on the very eastern edge of the state actually go to Boise. They're looking at closing four of those facilities in Salem, Eugene, Bend, and Pendleton. So the only Oregonians that will not have their ballots sent to Portland before they go back to their county election office are those on the far eastern edge that go to Boise, and those down in the Klamath Falls and Medford area where those will go to that processing facility. Anywhere else, the ballot's going to have to come to Portland, be processed and sort, and then sent back to the county elections office. That's going to add days in transit to if this comes to pass. That's going to add days of transit for those ballots, and the current service levels for first class return mail are not going to be able to be met. We've talked to the post office as part of that change. The Portland facility will operate 24 hours a day instead of currently they only, their main times are like from 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. So they'll be able to process ballots all day long. But we'll have to look, and the counties will have to look at changing some of their processes to be able to meet the new rules in order to have ballots move as quickly as possible. So the concern is, especially for those of our citizens that are in rural areas far away from the Portland Post Office, that their ballots are going to take longer to get to them and for them to come back in. And so that's why I just want to prepare you that, you know, if some of this comes to pass, that we need to do this, we may need to come and talk about changing 254-470, which is our window for mailing ballots out between the 18th day and the 14th day before the election. So that's all of the postal official issues. One other proposal that's out there is they're looking at creating an election class of mail that would have different rates to help others throughout the country move more towards our model of vote by mail and make it standard as far as the service level that's there, and you know, to help encourage others to utilize the mail for ballots. While we fully support others following our lead and moving to vote by mail, our concern is that election class postal rate is going to be 3 to 4 times the current rate that we are paying because of our relationship with the post office and the nonprofit standard rate that we have and have worked with them successfully. That's a concern of ours, and so we have been pushing to make sure that we are grandfathered in so that we are able to maintain that rate and that relationship we've had with the Postal Service. We have our congressional delegation up to speed on that in case we need to call them into action to help us on that front. And so far it looks like they are willing to help us out there and grandfather us in with the rate that we currently have. But we need to watch that and make sure that we don't end up doing more harm than good to our county budgets in with this election class mail rate. So we are watching that very closely. So that's That's my report. That's all the variables that are out there. There's no certainty to any of those things, and so that's why we are just watching and preparing different contingencies and trying to think through things that we can change in our business model and the counties in ballot delivery and other things to be able to make the best of whatever situation comes to us, and then trying to be as engaged as we can in the policymaking that's going on in Congress and at the Postal Commission.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve. Representative Freeman, then Representative Winger.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. And this may not be as completely obvious to everybody as it is to me, but pretty much everything you explained and went over makes a great case for doing away with vote by mail and going back to voting without using the Postal Service the way we used to do it. So thank you for that explanation.
Representative Winger.
I actually have some questions. have you thought at all about on the return envelope for this special election, printing on there a reminder around this, where the stamp goes, that it's going up by a cent, so you have that last warning to the voter that they need to put the right amount on?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, I've thought about a lot of things, and that's one of them. Most of the counties purchase their envelopes well in advance to get those done, and so I don't think that is a likely scenario, but we may talk about being able to print something on there with the labels that go out, and for sure it will be within the ballot packet itself to indicate that. But I think the envelopes as a whole have they're already on site and have been ordered to. They try to stay one election ahead just in case a special election pops up.
What's been the post office's history on ballots that are mailed without stamps? I mean, are they really returning them? Because I'd heard also that they have a tendency just to deliver them as well. I mean, what exactly has been going on?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, that is an issue that has been worked on to gain some consistency throughout the state. Current statute says that the voter shall pay the postage. And so when I came into this position, some counties were accepting ballots without postage and others were not, and they were returning them. And so working with the county clerks, we all came upon a uniform standard, which I believe they have all been following for the last year and a half, that if a ballot comes in with no postage, that the post office is to return that ballot to the voter to obtain the postage, and then they can send that back in.
Okay. Last follow-on. Mm-hmm. This idea of the Saturday delivery going away, and there might be kind of a bit of a delay, and also it all going through Portland. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the policy to look at the postmark on these ballots, or do you literally stop taking them on Tuesday at 8 o'clock? I mean, if something shows up with a Friday or Saturday postmark, you do not accept that as having been mailed on time?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, that's correct. Postmarks have no effect for Oregon elections in Washington State. They do validate that by postmark, but here the ballot has to be received in the clerk's office in their possession by 8 o'clock at the close of the polls. One other complication that Washington State is going through right now is actually the issue of the postmark. So if you drop it in a mailbox in Bend, and now it has to go to Portland and it takes 2 days to get there, that's when it's going to get postmarked. So just because where you drop it, it doesn't automatically get the postmark there. If it gets to the processing facility after 12:01, that postmark automatically rolls to the next date. And so that's an issue that those states that accept postmarks are having to deal with as well, that right now we don't have to.
I appreciate the dialogue, and I'm now leaning strongly in Representative Freeman's direction.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I have two items, if I may. Mm-hmm. The processing center we're talking about in Portland, is that the big facility that's down near the train station?
Yes.
Okay. That's item number one. Number two, how much more or less does vote by mail cost to administer for the counties and for you than the old system where you opened the polls at 8 o'clock in the morning, you ran till 8 o'clock at night, everybody came in and cast their ballot, and you hired poll workers and those kind of things? What's the difference in cost? Which costs more?
Madam Chair, Representative Barhart, the vote by mail is clearly less expensive, and when you have a...
A lot? A little?
I believe it was... I want to say... I'm not certain. I want to say $1.85 versus $1.05 per ballot. But I can, we can get you those precise numbers. But the issue with going to polling place elections is, are you going to strictly require attendance at the polling place, or are you going to allow absentee ballots, ballots for military and overseas? And then that adds complexities and costs, because in effect, then you're running two separate elections.
Well, like most states do now, in effect.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnard, correct, although it seems that more are moving towards vote by mail than away from it.
Could I just make a comment?
Sure.
All the complexities that we have to deal with aside, the post office reducing service is probably a huge mistake on their part. They've got a $5 billion shortfall, I think I read in the paper this morning. For the size of the country, that's a fairly small number, and you should be able to figure out how to make that up. But cutting services the way they're talking about, that they've explained to you that they're talking about doing, and increasing the time that it takes to deliver the mail, which is what it would do, substantial increase in the time to deliver the mail, I would think would have the effect of significantly reducing the amount of mail that they process, and therefore reducing their income.
We're already seeing a steep.
Yeah. I mean, even more than it has already been.
Madam Chair, one other point. Well, actually, two. Number one, we have a great working relationship with the post office and a good partnership there. And so I don't want this in any way to seem that we are being critical of them. And then number two, with the increasing use of drop sites, in many of our counties, a majority of the ballots now are returned via drop site and not through the mail. So that's something else that we're looking at, is if that's a solution, and especially as you get closer to election day. We tell people right now not to put their ballots in the mail after Friday, because there's no guarantee that they will get to us in time to be counted, and so they'll go to their drop boxes and drop sites. And so the counties have continued to increase the number of those available to voters, and the numbers of ballots dropped off at those drop sites continues to increase.
Thank you all. And Steve, I just want to clarify. All the changes at the federal level, 2013, likely. I mean, for some reason, the federal government decides to get very active and aggressive, and they did something in 2012. You mentioned statutory changes. If something happens after we're out of here in February, would you absolutely need a statutory change if something happened with some of the, you know, if there was a delay? Or I guess I'm just trying to figure out if that did happen next year, what situation?
So, Madam Chair, I think there's two different avenues going on here. Some of them are in Congress, which is the rate, the Saturday delivery. The others are the local post offices that are being reviewed for closure and the regional sorting facilities. And my understanding from meeting with postal officials is that is something that could happen as early as next spring. They're looking at that, no guarantees. And again, I don't, there's no certainty to that, but they are in the process of looking at those and deciding which ones to recommend to shut down. And those are things that can be administered solely within the USPS and not require an act of Congress, is my understanding. So we should know the results of their surveys, I would think, before you all gather again in February to know for sure about these regional sorting facilities and processing facilities, to make a decision then whether we would want to seek opening up and allowing those ballots to be mailed a day or two earlier. But until we know exactly what they're going to do, I think we should have different plans and think of all different options and then be ready to act once those policies are made that are out of our control.
That's good to know. I mean, obviously in this committee we have, flexibility in terms of bill drafts and deadlines, but it is a short session, so we'll need to know within much as much advance notice as possible if we need to do something.
Madam Chair, thank you. And in January, I can give you the latest update, and we should, hopefully we'll have some feeling on whether this is more likely or less likely to happen and whether we need to do some emergency legislation.
Sounds like we'll have you back in January.
I'm a fixture here. The last session I went for the perfect attendance award, but somehow I don't think 2012 will be any different.
I suspect not. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard just a little bit of the conversation from the Secretary of State when she was down in Medford on TV, something about Congressional District 1, about taking some iPads out to nursing homes and allowing people to vote via iPad. Would you explain that procedure and explain why we would do that?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative.
I may have misunderstood Esquivel. What she was saying, though.
Yes, so no votes were cast on an iPad. What did happen, we have a pilot project in the 1st Congressional District. We're required by federal law to provide voting technology for those with disabilities to have an accessible voting system. The system we've had for the last few years is a laptop with some extra keys and functionality there to be able to read the ballot back to a voter so that if they're blind, have dexterity issues, whatever, that they can vote independently. And so what we've been testing is whether we can use an iPad or other tablets to be able to provide this accessible voting tool to voters that need those tools. And how it works is a voter will pull up their ballot, enter their name and their birth date. They usually have the ballot right there with them that was mailed to them. But for vision purposes or they have a hard time marking the ballot, they can pull up the ballot on the iPad where they can read it, enlarge the size of the screen, have it read the ballot to them. They can mark it with just a touch rather than having to fill in a bubble with the pen if they have a difficult time doing that. And then they take that, press a button, and it prints out a piece of paper on a wireless printer, so just like a printer that you would have in your office, and then the voter can then verify that that's who they voted for, seal that up, put it in an envelope just like they would their regular ballot, and mail it in. So what it does really is it's a tool for those that would not be able to mark the ballot with a pen like the majority of us do, and serves as that accessibility tool for voters.
She didn't explain it that way, so
thank you for clarification.
Thank you.
In fact, she didn't explain it very well at all. So.
This has been a worldwide story over the last week. We've had inquiries from many states and local jurisdictions all inquiring because we really think this is a way. It's got promising results so far, but a way that we can really save resources to be able to serve these voters. And it also has many more functions. You can allow people to hear the voter's pamphlet arguments read to them if they can't read the small print of the voter's pamphlet. You can track your ballot. You can see if you're registered to vote. You could even register to vote through our online system on that tool. So again, it's a tool. It's not storing any ballots, counting any ballots. It's just it's a big electronic pencil that helps us to comply with the law at a much cheaper price than our current system.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I got to witness this at Washington County elections for on Election Day, and it's pretty amazing technology. The what they've been using in the past is quite a lot of equipment that they'd have to lug around, and just the ease of moving an iPad and a small wireless printer was pretty amazing to see the technology. So I'm sure we could, you know, get an update on how that pilot went when you come back in January as well, because that might be worth it. Because you should have some numbers by then and how that works.
Absolutely, and we will be right in the heart of it for the special right. election there. And we already learned some things through this round that we'll be able to improve the ease of use, both for the voter and for the election official. And that's one of the other big advantages of this, is that it's much easier for voters and for election officials to use and administer than any system we've had before.
Yes, Representative Barnett, last word.
Just one quick comment. Mm-hmm. I assume then that these devices, because they're general use devices, can be used for something else when you're not trying to collect ballots.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, absolutely, and that's another beauty of the system, is that it's not something that only comes out 2 days every 2 years or 4 days during that process, and can be used for other functionality. And it also updates all of the accessibility features automatically, so we don't have to go out and invest in software upgrades and updates on our own homegrown system.
Thank you, Representative. And I think with that, thank you, Steve. Good to see you. See you
thank
in
you.
January. With that, we're complete, and we'll see you in January. We'll close the informational, and we're adjourned.